All right, it is Friday, February 3rd, 2017. I'm still not used to that yet, and I can't believe it's already February. So, Grayson, I know you're going on vacation next week, so we're going to miss the podcast next week, but we've got a lot to talk about today. I have been doing classes on taxes, so I think I know what my topic is for today, and I'm sure you could guess.
Joy.
And I know that you're going to be on the fringe of political today. There's been a lot going on, and obviously there's always things we can talk about from the political side, but we always try to stay out of that as much as we can, unless we're looking at it through the investing side. So, Grayson, why don't you kind of give us an introduction to what you want to talk about today, and let's be as careful as we can not to debate the world of politics, no matter whether we like them or not.
I want to talk about the Donald.
All right. Let's just jump right in.
It's obviously, the most contentious election season, campaign season I can remember. I don't think Mike Dukakis and Ronald Reagan had the wars that Hillary and the Donald did, but it's been pretty crazy. Now, of course, like you're talking about, looking at these political events from the perspective of what does it do to the financial markets? The entire financial world is watching, right? Because we have we're in some uncharted territory. So I guess you look at the Donald has already done 19 executive orders as of...
Wait a second. Is it noon?
Right.
Noon Eastern time. I think there's a few more coming.
Also, presidential memorandums, which is, more of a philosophical sort of statement the presidents will put out, but every little word that is spoken that comes out, the markets are reacting. The Donald made a comment that he thought the pharmaceutical companies were making too much money, and just as that information comes out, the big drug companies' stock prices got smashed in short order. So there's some crazy stuff going on, and I'm not sure. When the market digests the whole thing, it's still going higher.
It's an interesting world we have out there. That's for sure. I cannot call myself a fan of Donald Trump. So nobody get that impression. But it's weird. Sometimes I find myself defending Trump, and sometimes I find myself shaking my head going, what planet do I live on?
Oh,
this
I know.
Is well, a president.
That's the crazy part about this. Even these executive orders kind of have something for everybody, He talked about draining the swamp, so he goes in and one of his executive orders talks about the time that an ex-lobbyist, administrative employees have to sign a non-compete, so to speak, that they'll never lobby a foreign government. Well, everybody, think whatever you want about the Donald, you have to like that, right? I mean, that's a good thing. That's trying to remove, the pay me and I'll do you favors with the position that I have kind of stuff. And then I believe it was 5 years after they're in the administration that they have to wait before becoming a lobbyist again. So, again, you have to say that's great. Well, then on the other side of it, instead of having to wait 2 years after being a lobbyist to become an administrative employee, it got lowered to one. So it's almost like there's something... You can look at this I mean, who?
We want to take advantage of it now.
Right.
But after our administration, we don't want anybody else to take advantage of it until they change the rules.
Yeah, so obviously that doesn't have a lot of influence on financial markets and that sort of thing. But I use that as an example of how, you know, it's tough to get a handle on exactly what's going on. In general, there's an undeniable lower regulation bend to all of Trump's actions. Undeniably, in general, regulation's coming down.
Well, and I think the news that's rattling today is about the fiduciary rule coming out and either getting delayed or getting taken apart and dismantled. And I use the air quotes around the fiduciary rule. That's a marketing name like a high-income mutual fund.
High-income bond fund.
High-income bond fund, which really is, in the real world, is a junk bond fund.
It's a junk bond fund, right.
And in the equivalent of calling the fiduciary rule regulations coming out, they're marketed as the most wonderful thing that should have always been in place, which is putting the onus of the fiduciary standard on all advisors out there that are recommending financial products, and saying that they have to be in the best interest of the client. But unfortunately, the fiduciary rule really does none of that and creates a huge storm of regulation through lawsuit. It opens a huge window to basically say we'll figure this all out with lawsuits, and it just becomes very, very messy in the future, and really has nothing to do with the individual having to make decisions on the best interest of the client. There's nothing in the regulation that forces that. As a matter of fact, it basically puts that on somebody else. The individual still does exactly what they do on a daily basis. So,
well, yeah, it's you know, like so much government regulation. I mean, the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act removed more of your liberties than any single piece of legislation ever.
Hey, but it made gold a currency.
Well, but the point being, how we talk about this legislation is very often 180 degrees from what the legislation actually does. Here, I want to read this, Scott. So,
okay.
Just a news wire. It says Trump also will halt another of Obama's regulations known as the fiduciary rule, hated by the financial industry, that requires advisors on retirement accounts to work in the best interest of their clients. Wow.
So they're saying we don't do that. Well, one, Grayson, you are technically a fiduciary as the registered investment advisor.
I'm a fiduciary anyway. So this legislation wouldn't have had much of an impact on me anyhow, but I watch especially on the fixed annuity side, on the life insurance, on the
dinner seminar guys. Come on, let's go down to it.
You dinner seminar guys. And this fiduciary rule would not have helped the end user. If anything, it would have hurt the end user. Yet it's talked about in the media like, oh, well, this is the rule that's going to make everything nice and rosy.
Well, the fact is the whole insurance industry found their way around it. It's an extra piece of paper to sign that a slick salesman will get anybody to sign. And the individual ultimately, in the fine print of all that regulation, the individual making the recommendations does not have any of the responsibility that a fiduciary has. It's getting signed off by the company issuing the annuity or some middleman, not by the individual.
Right. It doesn't make any sense.
So it's incredible.
So that's one of the things that's getting pulled by the Trump administration. So in general, there's definitely a trend of less regulation.
Yes.
And some people think that's good. Some people think that's bad. The financial markets in general are appreciating that. So, again, however we digest and try to look at the minutia and every tiny little detail, at the end of the day, the market's digesting all of this information and it continues higher. So, we gotta hang on.
Do we need to worry about trade with Australia?
No.
Okay.
No. Well, Trump really threw so much egg in the face of the major media outlets that anything that doesn't look smooth as silk that he does, he's going to get some crazy scrutiny on, and any tiny little bump in the road is going to get extrapolated to infinity. So, no, there's nothing to worry about with Australia.
Do we need to worry about trade with Mexico?
Trade with Mexico, that may be a different story.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Look,
Does that directly increase costs? Because we do get a lot of goods from Mexico. We get a lot of things made in Mexico. We get a lot of food from Mexico. Does just a shutdown of the border and the NAFTA instantly show us some inflation?
Yes.
That's kind of the only thought in my head is, look, we can replace it and find somebody else to make it and do all those things, but all those cost of goods are going to increase.
Yes.
And, you know, then all of a sudden the American farmers are selling their goods here in the United States instead of abroad. The NAOS or whatever it is, the subsidies that our government pays the small farmers to not use their land, that starts opening up that land and we start farming that land because we need to replace all the produce and everything that we get from Mexico because we get a ton.
Yeah, we do. I don't think it's going to stop. This isn't going to completely stop. But change is always painful. The enforcing of the border rules, something had to be done. I'm not even here to claim that I think that Donald's doing the right thing, but something had to be done, and change is always painful. So we're going to have to. I'm going to have to take a pass on really diving into this subject because I don't think we really know how this is going to roll out. Right now, it does appear that the Donald is plowing forward full steam ahead on building the wall.
Well, and the wall is one thing. That doesn't stop trade. But shutting down NAFTA and going into a Cold War with Mexico, the only thing I see out of that, living in Arizona, obviously, it's pretty close to us. But the only thing I see out of that is really some inflation on stuff that we've seen deflation on. You know, the whole world of food and produce and all that type of stuff has been pretty darn cheap.
Well, and if we want to talk about investing, I mean, and this is not even a joke, if anyone's listening to this and they're thinking about buying a property in Mexico, Mexico is on sale right now.
Yeah.
It is. That's not even a joke. If you're going to, you want a retirement home in Guadalajara, now's your time to do it.
Guadalajara.
Wherever. I just pulled that out of the sky. You know what I'm saying. Mexico is on sale.
Rocky Point. There you go. That's a four-hour drive. All right.
Well, the thing is, Rocky Point, most everything in Rocky Point is still done in U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
You go further south or further into mainland on Mexico, and stuff's done in the peso. And again, the peso is on sale. So
yeah. Super cheap.
So that's what I wanted to address that. Another thing that we have to, the jobs report this morning, Bill Gross, formerly known as the Bond King, regarded this report as schizophrenic. So it looks a lot different. This is really the Trump administration, or the first of these reports, you know, under the Trump administration. And it's crazy. So there was a surge in full-time jobs. Okay. There was a sell-off or a decrease in part-time jobs. But the thing that I think is really worthy of note is the people, you know, we have almost 100 million Americans of working age not in the workforce. Okay?
100 million?
Almost 100 million American, 94 million whatever Americans, not in the workforce, not in the labor force.
Well, so you're talking about retirees?
No, of working age.
Of working, Okay, of working age, so 18 to 62 is probably what that number
I think they're
would
using
be.
65 or 66 now, okay. Because, you know, that's...
So 18 to 65, there's 100 million people not employed.
Right.
Okay. What was it in the last report from Obama?
The point being, everybody, when we're looking at unemployment numbers, the entire financial community understands that this is not a legitimate statistic. If you use how the Labor Department used to calculate unemployment numbers, for example, back in the 80s, you know, we'd have some 8, 9, 10% unemployment, maybe more. So they just keep calculating unemployment differently. And a big part of that was a lot of people that were considered not in the labor force, right? So you were looking for, you got fired, you were looking for a job, you quit looking for a job, and the Labor Department would push you off the back end and you wouldn't be considered unemployed because you're not looking for a job anymore. So the entire, you know, when we talk about capacity utilization and how good, how well is the economy humming along, oh, well, we're, you know, almost utilizing our entire capacity because look at the unemployment numbers so low. Yeah, that's fudging statistics. It's not really legitimate. So now all of a sudden, you know, some 700,000 people are added back into the labor force on this first report under the Trump administration, and so unemployment ticks up, right, with that many people getting pushed back into the labor force.
Into the unemployed labor force number.
Right.
Okay. So 700,000 jump from report to report in the number of people that were unemployed but are part of the labor force.
Right. 736,000 is the number.
Did it come from the employed?
So this is people that...
that just appeared. So...
people entering back into the labor force.
Well, but what's crazy is think about the amount of people that are turning 65 and, let's say, exiting the labor force versus the number of people that are turning 18. We all know the baby boomers are retiring right now, so this number could be even more than 700,000 just appearing out of nowhere.
Right.
So I wanted to make sure that, you know, that's why this is really... strange.
Very strange.
And without coming right out and saying it, maybe these people, well, let's just come out and say it. Maybe these people were just being excluded on the previous reports to make the numbers look good.
That's kind of my point, you know, but 736,000 back into the labor force, that doesn't all of a sudden, magically in 1 month, take us to an accurate depiction of what the labor market
is. No, it definitely doesn't.
So I'm wondering, is this just a blip on the radar, or is this a trend to where the Labor Department has gotten a mandate to adjust how they're calculating?
Well, here...
I don't know.
If I became president and I wanted to look good, I would want the numbers to look really bad when I go in. So anything, you know, so I only have one direction to go, which is up.
Well, and that's, you know, you look at historically takeovers, mergers, and that sort of thing. Usually a new administration or a new CEO, new leadership in a company will come in and absolutely fire sale the place.
Yeah, clean it out.
Clean it out, blow it up, numbers hit the floor. then of course they get all their stock options and all that's good, all those goodies from there, and now we start trying to take the numbers higher again. So, but I guess that's still a little bit incomplete information, because then on the other side of the Labor Department says that the...
Well, it's good to bring up that mentality, though, because this is really the first time we've had a, air quotes, people, successful businessman in the business world, a CEO-type person at the helm. And the mentality, when you go in and take over companies, when I got my MBA and all those wonderful things, the mentality is always go in and gut the place. You know, employees don't like new bosses. It's just the reality of it, you know. So you gut the place, you clean it all out, and you build it back the way you want to run it, and hopefully you had the right vision. And so, you know, the mentality of a businessman is typically that way when you get to that CEO level.
Right. So this is still a little bit incomplete information out of the Labor Department this morning, because they said that wage growth wasn't so strong, which took us back in financial markets to a kind of bad is good, right? If wages aren't growing, the Federal Reserve looks at wage growth probably more than anything when talking about inflation pressures, right?
Sure.
So if the wage growth isn't that good, oh, okay, well, maybe Yellen doesn't have to jack up the discount rate here in February, or, you know, maybe doesn't have to raise three times in 2017, how they talked about. So let's go buy stocks.
So wait a second. Is inflation driven by wages? So if companies don't want to pay anybody more, then we won't ever have inflation ever again?
That's right. Well, it's you know...
Which came first?
Yeah. It's a little bit of a chicken and the egg thing, but, you know, when you look at core CPI, when you look at consumer inflation, yeah, we don't worry so much about that. There's not a multiple on that, and how it affects... That's kind of the end of the road, is consumer CPI. But on the front end of the road is the input costs for businesses to create their products and services. If those costs are going higher, then those costs plus administrative issues plus the profit they have to make, there's kind of a multiple by the time we get to the final good or service. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. And, you know, when you really look at it that way, that's where the age of technology has kept inflation away.
Absolutely.
It's incredible how much technology makes anything more efficient and less labor needed.
Yeah.
And so thus pushing costs down. And now we seem to, and I don't know if this is, you want to call it a rut or whatever the case may be, but the reality is wages haven't increased for a decade or more.
In real terms, inflation adjusted terms, wages have been going down for decades.
Yeah, it's incredible. And so I don't know if that makes it a rut.
They're still a little bit
higher. I don't know if that makes it a rut. If companies are decades into used to not giving raises,
right?
What makes you want to give a raise? The norm is becoming no raises or very tiny small raises.
Well, and that's okay. So that's really the biggest controversy with Donald Trump, right? Because he's arguing that so much of our manufacturing, so much of our business has gone overseas because of NAFTA-type deals, chasing cheap labor overseas, that has really gutted the middle class, really gutted our manufacturing base here in America. And he's vowing to change that. So that's the real controversy. I mean, there are economists. I mean, if all economists agree on something, you can be certain that 180 degree opposite of whatever they agree on is more accurate. But most economists don't appreciate a lot of government involvement and a lot of tariffs and a lot of Smoot-Hawley Act, or however you say that, from the 1930s, a lot of people consider exacerbated and amplified the Great Depression. right? Things weren't going well in the early 30s here, so a bunch of tariffs got erected by our government, and a lot of people consider that to be the last nail in the coffin that made the Depression really last until the Second World War. So,
and the tariffs were a barrier to import or export?
Well, both, but mostly the focus was foreign countries sending us goods. There was a big tariff at the border.
Gotcha. Okay. So we didn't want the goods coming in. We wanted the jobs internally.
Right. Theoretically. Right. Theoretically. And that's exactly where the Donald's going. And so, I mean, who knows? I mean, obviously, this is huge with the Chinese because we consume so many Chinese produced goods. And right now the Mexico thing is at front and center in this debate and these arguments. We'll see. You know, the dollar, the US dollar strength, that trend has really subsided or weakened or isn't showing the kind of power that it did a month ago, a month and a half ago. And a lot of people are considering that's because there's going to be some trade war stuff going on with what the Donald is proposing.
And it's hard for me to put a finger on that. I mean, it's always nice to reminisce.
It's hard for anybody to put a finger on
and go back to, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have the car manufacturing and all that type of stuff. But I still go back to the big Chinese businessman that is planning on moving all of his manufacturing facility to the United States because he has done an analysis that shows that it's cheaper for him to do it here.
Well, yeah.
So we may be in a different atmosphere where Donald may create an atmosphere that makes people want to bring their manufacturing here as opposed to, no, you're not allowed to.
Well, in general, capital is going to flow to where it's treated best, right?
Yeah.
You put a lot of trade barriers up, you put a lot of tariffs, that's, in general, you're just going to make more problems because capital wants to go where it is treated best. So you rewind 15 years, you rewind 20 years, so much cheap labor in China, especially back then. A lot of manufacturing went there. The discrepancy, the margin, so to speak, between what labor costs in America and what it costs overseas is much smaller now than it was back then.
Well, and they have what was described as a very intrusive government taxation system for these businesses that are in there that really squashes their ability to profit like they could here in the United States.
Yeah. Right.
And so the taxation was one of the big reasons, and the ability to get much favorable status tax-wise here in the United States and get cheap land and the labor might be a little more expensive, but it's certainly made up by the cheap land, the cheap facilities,
the cheap energy,
all of those things. So that's what I found very interesting. And I don't, for me, it was either encouraging or not, you know, depending on how you look at it. I've always thought about manufacturing jobs. How do you really talk about the middle class when we talk about jobs that typically are not middle class pay?
Well, yeah, it's difficult to define the middle class these days.
Well, I completely agree, but my, I guess, counter-argument to that is the world of technology going to robotics and the more manufacturing going to robotics makes you still need management there. You still need robotics engineers and software engineers, and the amount of technology-related jobs that are in manufacturing and management jobs that are in manufacturing, that's where the middle-class wages are. And that's what I find very interesting about manufacturing in this day and age. There's a lot more middle-class jobs in it than there are just the remedial stand on a line and pick things up and put them down, you know? It's not like that anymore.
It really isn't. So there are a lot of changes I mean, stay tuned with, especially with all these executive orders. And we, I mean, we didn't even talk about his immigration ban from seven countries: Iraq, Iran, Yemen, the Sudan. I mean, it's crazy. The water's heating up. But right now, the financial markets are liking the Trump administration. So just a foreshadowing for our next talk. Amazing what the American oil and gas industry, the efficiencies and the technologies that they have are, in my opinion, going to really shock the world in fairly short order. It's amazing what the American oil and gas industry has done.
So we can produce it cheaper than anybody else.
Not only that, but to a degree never even thought possible, we can turn the switch on and off.
Right.
That's the big variable difference, is we can turn the switch on and off. You should see how quickly, just because crude oil is holding in the 50s, it's amazing how quickly the oil and gas industry responds and turns the lights back on.
Great. All right. Well, we can talk a little bit about, I guess, taxation. I'm doing classes on tax efficiency in retirement, which is something I personally enjoy doing. And Grayson, do you like taxes?
Nope.
Well, I thank you for paying your fair share. I know you enjoy writing the checks. So the topics and virtually all February, I'm doing tax efficiency and retirement at every location we teach our classes in. And to me, it's something that I'm passionate about, because I really get disgruntled when I look at the industry I'm in. And I notice that CPAs don't do anything but answer questions. So if you don't ask, they don't have advice for you. They just record the information and hand you your tax returns, for the most part. And most people don't know the right questions to ask. And so then they look at their, air quotes, financial advisor for help with becoming efficient in their portfolio. And the tremendous amount of retirees, the taxation that they are paying is heavily dependent on the advice they're getting from their financial advisors that are choosing the investments. And I really have a huge problem with our entire industry not having a knowledge base necessary to make decisions on investing when it comes to the influence of taxes. Because our taxation is different depending on the type of money you have and the type of investments you have. So it becomes very frustrating to me why someone would pay an advisor fees to manage their portfolio and advise them on investments when they have no idea what they're doing when it comes to taxation. Because their mistakes can cause additional costs, in many cases, 10 to 15% more taxation, which is, for a lot of people, thousands of dollars that you're just throwing away, and you're paying this person to throw your own money away. And I get frustrated when I see things like that. So, Grayson, if I buy a racehorse with my IRA money,
mm-hmm.
How is it taxed?
You mean when you make withdrawals from that racehorse?
Yes.
It's taxed as ordinary income coming out.
Okay, so let's say my racehorse wins a derby.
Well, you better, because if he doesn't, the RMDs, you're going to have to cut parts off.
Well, I'm 40 years old. Okay, so let's just say he wins a derby and I deposit all the winnings into my IRA account. Was there any taxable event?
Nope.
If I sold the horse and deposited all the money in an IRA account, is there any taxable event?
Nope.
If I buy that racehorse with after-tax money, money that's not in an IRA, that's not in a Roth account, and the horse wins a derby, do I owe taxes on the winnings?
Sure.
Okay. So if I sell the, if I bought the horse for $5,000 and sell it for $10,000, do I owe taxes on that?
Sure.
Okay.
What if you converted your IRA horse to a Roth IRA horse?
That'd be a crazy horse. Theoretically, you can do that. You're going to pay taxes on that. But now all your winnings, which would be really smart, because if you think he's going to win a race and his, the horse's value is, say, $10,000, pay taxes on the $10,000, throw it in your Roth account, and then go win that Derby, and all the winnings are completely tax-free.
Ooh. Investment strategy number one. Your Roth IRA should own a racehorse.
which I use as an example. Technically, you can own a racehorse in your IRA or Roth IRA. But so the difference between these three...
Well, really, really quick, Scott, yep. I want to rewind a little bit because obviously you're better versed in taxes than I am. But when I do see you talking to people about IRAs, Roth IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, after-tax accounts, all this kind of stuff, I see a very common confusion. People don't seem to understand investment choice versus tax status account.
And I'm getting there, and I'm actually right now just kind of, I'm depicting you got three different tax classes of money. So you have IRA money that is tax deferred. You've never paid taxes on it. This is a moniker from the IRS designating money as you've never paid taxes on it, and the taxable events don't happen until you choose to withdraw money, and every dollar you take out of IRA is just taxable income like you made it on a W-2. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Roth money is a special moniker from our IRS that says you never have to pay taxes on this money ever again. You've already paid taxes on the principal that went in there, and all the gains in the future are non-taxable, and any withdrawals are non-taxable. Okay? After tax, the rest of the money that you paid taxes on, you saved it, and then you invested, that is what I call non-qualified, what the industry calls non-qualified money. It's money that you've already paid taxes on that you own individually or joint with your spouse that that gets taxed along the way. Anytime a event happens where you sell something for a profit or you gain a dividend or you earn interest, you are taxed on it as you receive those profits. So those are the three tax classes. That's the IRS moniker for the type of money, okay? You're allowed to invest those types of money in anything you want, whether it's the racehorse, whether it's investment property, real estate, whether it's a stock, a bond, a mutual fund, an annuity, not necessarily life insurance. I'll leave that off the table. But the reality is you can invest your money in anything you want. So the tax class is completely separate from the investment choice. And these financial advisors get paid to make investment choices. And they really should pay attention to the type of money they're putting the type of investments in. So Grayson, let me ask you something. We see a lot of people come in with municipal bonds.
Yep.
What do you think of municipal bonds in general as an investment?
They can be useful.
They can be useful. Wonderful. Okay, well, that's a good way to look at this. So it's a financial tool that someone can invest their money in. So let's look at things that don't make sense. Functionally, why would somebody invest in a municipal bond versus a corporate bond?
It's typically because of the tax-free status of the interest earnings.
Okay, so Grayson, municipal bonds, tax-free. Well, why wouldn't I just put all my money in there?
Well, because it's tax-free.
It's better. Stop there. I like municipal bonds. They're tax-free.
Slow your roll. Because it's tax-free, a lot of retirees are attracted to them, just like you're talking about. So typically, the risk-reward interest rate is a little bit lower than a corporate bond.
Okay. Well, so But theoretically, an A-rated corporate bond and an A-rated municipal bond.
Typically, the municipal bond will yield a little bit lower.
A little bit lower.
Because it is tax-free.
But theoretically, they have the same risk profile because they're both A-rated.
Well, we're doing our best to compare apples to apples.
Apples to apples. Okay.
Doing our best to.
So if I looked at a 30-year general obligation, A-rated municipal bond, and a 30-year A-rated corporate bond. About a percent difference? Somewhere right around there?
Probably a little bit lower because the interest rates on those are so low. But, yeah, somewhere around there.
That's somewhere probably around a percent difference.
Yeah.
Just for easy math.
For easy math, call it a percent, yeah.
Okay. So if I put $100,000 in a municipal bond that says, let's just say it earns 3% interest, and $100,000 in a corporate bond that earns 4%, which
we get it.
It could be more, but okay. So a taxable 4% interest on a $100,000 municipal bond is, or 4% on a $100,000 corporate bond is $4,000. Okay, that's how much interest I earned that year, but I owe taxes on that. But I own a municipal bond that has no taxation, and I get 3%, which is $3,000. So the question now is, what's better for you, a tax-free $3,000 or a taxable $4,000? Well, if you're in the 15% tax bracket, Grayson, what's 15% of $4,000?
$600.
$600 in taxation. So you take that out of the $4,000 you earned, and you have $3,400 after-tax profit from that investment.
We should tell listeners to get a pen and paper before Scott starts talking.
So Grayson,
he's a numbers nerd. Next time, please show up to the podcast with pen and paper.
So, but really what this just boils everything down to is if you're in the 15% tax bracket, the corporate bond's probably a better investment for you because $3,400 after tax is better than $3,000 tax-free. That's the math I just did.
In your example, you're absolutely right. Everybody needs to consider that.
Well, but Grayson,
if municipal bonds are generally, in general, they're for higher tax bracket people.
So Grayson, now this discussion really applies to the after-tax money.
Oh, it does?
Yeah, because what if I put the corporate bond and the municipal bond in my Roth account?
Corporate bond, municipal bond in your Roth account, the municipal bond is completely handicapping the core competency of a municipal bond by putting it in your Roth.
Because corporate bonds are tax-free in Roth accounts.
Right.
Okay. So, in general, because I can't find any in my head right now, is there any reason to put a municipal bond in a Roth account?
No, not that I can think of.
Because literally,
if
anything
that's your
you
only money.
Yeah, literally, the anything you put in your Roth account is completely tax free. Period. And
that's not entirely true. Sometimes, if you own some foreign assets, it may be irrelevant that you've got a Roth account owning it. The foreign government's going to want some taxes.
Okay, well, extreme behavior aside.
I'm just trying to make sure we're...
But the point is, a municipal bond has no place in a Roth IRA or in a Roth account whatsoever because the equivalent corporate bond that is taxable pays a higher rate of interest. Even if it was 0.01% higher interest, it still makes no sense to put the municipal in a Roth account. So, Grayson, what if I put the municipal bond in an IRA and the corporate bond in the IRA? The municipal pays 3 tax-free, the corporate pays 4 taxable. But they're both in my IRA. Which one's better?
Well, in general, the corporate bond's going to be better.
Well, anything that pays 4% versus 3% is better. But my municipal bond's tax-free.
It's in your IRA. It's not tax-free.
Ooh. So wait a second. No matter what I put in my IRA, I'm going to pay ordinary taxes on, even if it's a tax-free investment?
That's correct.
So if the corporate bond pays 4% and the municipal bond pays 3%, and I still got to pay taxes on the 3%?
That's correct.
Why would I ever put a municipal bond in an IRA?
Probably not the smartest thing to do.
Okay. So when I look at taxation and I look at this glorification of tax-free investments, they have to be wisely put in right places.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing we learn from this little easy exercise here is just tax-free investments don't have any place in your Roth or in your IRA. They just don't, in general. For all of us normal people that aren't going and buying foreign entities and profiting in foreign countries and all these weird things, racehorses and this and that, for all of us normal people out there, municipal bonds.
I think there are some normal people that would take offense to you categorizing yourself as one of them. I'm just saying.
Well, the reality is we have to be very careful, and anybody that's giving you investment advice needs to understand some of these basic principles. Because I got news for you. If the difference is 4% or 3% versus corporate or tax-free municipal, even at 25%, you're at a break-even. Because taxes on $4,000 worth of income at 25% is $1,000, which now makes it tax-free or after-tax $3,000 profit. Well, compared to the tax-free $3,000, you're breaking even. And most retirees are not in a higher tax bracket than 25%. So the reality is we have to be very careful when we're looking at these situations, and we have to choose investments based on individual needs. Not that taxes drive our investment suggestions. They help guide them.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look at the 15% tax bracket, I make sure people, especially in our class, which I try to make taxes entertaining.
Oh, my goodness. If you can do that, you're way smarter than me.
But here's the thing. A married...
You're way more entertaining than me.
Married joint tax return, the 15% tax bracket, even if you're not itemizing, you're just a standard deduction. Let's say you're over 65. The top of the tax bracket is $75,900 plus... the standard deduction of $12,700, plus if you're over 65, you get $1,250 each, so that's $2,500, plus there's two of you if you're married, that's an exemption each of $4,050, so another $8,100 equals $99,200 of ordinary income, meaning up to 85% of your Social Security, all your pensions, all your IRA withdrawals, all the interest you earn on any investments, including corporate bonds or CDs or annuities or any of that type of stuff. Not long-term capital gains and qualified dividends from your after-tax savings, but everything else. You can have $99,200 worth of that income before you worry about paying 25% taxes. So in general, a tax-efficient retirement is trying to pay 15% and no more. That's how I really define a tax-efficient retirement. Any money you pass to your heirs, if they're still working, they're most likely going to be paying more than you're going to be paying in retirement if you're staying within your 15% tax bracket.
Okay, so I think I understand that question. If Mitt Romney is listening, do you have any suggestions for him?
Mitt Romney, quote-unquote, the largest IRA known to man. I think he's approaching 70, isn't he?
I think he's approaching 70, yeah.
That is the largest required minimum distribution ever.
How does he remain in the 15% tax bracket?
it's a little too late. And I always joke about people coming to me that are 69 years old or 70 years old, and they look at their first required minimum distribution and ask me how to save them on taxes, and every penny they have in savings is IRA.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, this
hard.
Really needs to be addressed in the early 60s. For people, I guess you could just categorize yourself as someone who needs an analysis of this. If you have an IRA that is, what would you say, Scott, more than 50% of your investable assets?
Look, as far as I'm concerned, the taxation and the world of taxation and the choice of investments are incredibly important, I would say, from the 59.5 to 70.5 range. At 70.5, it's still important, but you have required minimum distributions. Depending on the layout of how much money you have in IRA versus Roth versus all of those things, your hands are somewhat tied once you get to required minimum distribution and your ability to make things better. But that time period prior to 70.5 is when you have the opportunity to really make a big difference. But understand, everybody needs to pay attention to the choice of investments. If we're really trying to be as efficient as we possibly can, each investment has its place. You know, not that municipal bonds are not worth looking at. It's just simply that somebody in the 15% tax bracket should not be looking at them, and they certainly shouldn't be put in your Roth IRA or your IRA. So that's just the reality of it. So when I see portfolios walking in all the time with these municipal bonds, unfortunately, I know exactly what went on. A market maker who's probably in the middle of the lawsuit sold you bonds that are on their books.
Well, and it, you know, yeah.
That they needed to get off their books.
And I hate, I don't like making broad generalizations. Don't ever put municipal bond in your IRA, but there's even yet another problem that you haven't even addressed. You know, these municipal bonds, if you're talking about general obligation municipal bonds, you're talking about the 3% range, right?
Yeah.
You're not getting a good interest rate, and I see IRAs loaded up with these things. Well, what do you do required minimum distribution time? The 3% interest rate is not going to pay your required minimum distribution. Now you're forced to sell one of these, or how you're forced to liquidate, and forced liquidation doesn't matter what asset it is. If some other force other than you and your investing strategy, if some other force is making you liquidate, it's always at the wrong time.
Well, not only that, but the way bonds sell versus the way stocks sell are completely different worlds. And a lot of people don't realize they think, okay, well, a stock, I look at the stock market, it says the price is $55. If I hit a button and say sell, it's going to sell pretty darn close to the $55.
Instantly.
Well, the problem with bonds is if you know, one, it's not an efficient market like that, first of all. Two, you have to find a buyer of it. And three, an overwhelming amount of these municipal bonds are very thinly traded, mm-hmm. meaning there's not a good history of what the actual price and value is out there. So there's a lot of entities out there that are the buyers on the side of people that just hit a button and say sell, not offer it at this price. And so when you hit the button to sell, you're just taking whoever gives you the first offer.
There's not a button to hit. You got to call somebody.
Yeah. So
and say sell. And then they say, okay, we'll be back to you. And, well, here's where we sold it at. Wait a second. I thought it was worth this. Well, there wasn't a buyer at that. We found a buyer, or we were the buyer at the lower price.
So the other way that you sell the world of bonds is you say, well, here's the price I think it's worth. Let's put that out there and see if anybody wants to buy it at that price. Right. And that's two different ways to sell bonds. And trust me, there's a huge difference. You tell your advisor to sell your bonds, they hit, quote unquote, hit the proverbial button and say, who wants them? Take them. They don't really care what they're selling them at. You said sell them.
Well, yeah, but it depends on who your advisor is. There are certain shops that make their money off the spread.
That's right. What does that mean, Grayson?
Well, that means maybe they really care where your account sells the bond and where another account buys the bond.
So wait a second. Are you telling me the company that my advisor works for might be the one buying it from me and then flipping it and selling it to somebody else for a profit?
That's what I'm telling you.
Really?
That's right.
And do they love thinly traded bonds so there's not really a market to buy or sell it other than themselves?
That's pretty much the idea.
All right. So we've seen a lot of entities getting in trouble. Lawson, I think, is officially out of business or not. We don't like name names.
Let's not name names.
But there are entities out there that are getting in a lot of trouble for this. And the bigger companies, there are lawsuits out there going on, and restitutions already out there. But we do need to be very careful about this world, and we're seeing a lot of these games in the municipal bonds, and they don't even have any place in your portfolio. In a lot of the situations I'm seeing, they have no place in the portfolio.
Right.
Forget the games that are being played. In the first place, they shouldn't have been recommended.
Well, right. And let's also address corporate bonds, because the market-making mechanism, the buyers and sellers, hey, I want to buy a corporate bond, hey, I want to liquidate a corporate bond that I own, the market-making mechanism of buyers and sellers has drastically changed since 2009. Okay, so I want to address that as well. It's just thinner. There aren't as many buyers. There aren't as many sellers. So I liken it to, and I know you get a kick out of this, I liken it to a Roach Motel.
We're talking about bond mutual funds?
No, we're talking about individual, whether it's, well.
Yeah, individual bonds. Okay.
But that's my point. The market-making mechanism has been gutted like a fish by our regulatory agencies. So if you have if you have an IBM bond, if you have an Apple bond, and you say market sell, you're probably not going to get hurt too bad. Right, there would be plenty of buyers for those, but the further out the risk curve we go, the thinner and thinner and thinner that this world gets. So it's something to be aware of. If you have municipal and corporate bonds in your portfolio, just be aware that liquidating those might be more work than you think it is.
Yeah, and don't tell. Most advisors, you've got to be very careful when you tell them to sell my bonds. Just be very careful about that. We've seen some problems with that lately. All right, so I wanted to wrap it up and just make sure everybody knows we're over in Mesa on the 7th, New Frontiers, at the Mesa Community College, Red Mountain. It's a great program they have going out there, and very cheap to join. So if you're in the Mesa area, the community college has a continuing ed program. I want to say it's something like $50 a year or something that, and take all the classes you want. It's a really neat program. New Adventures in Learning is the one over in Sun Lakes that we do. Again, another community college, Mesa Chandler Community College. We're teaching classes there, similar type program, fantastic. Join them and take all the classes you want. Lots of great entertaining classes in there. And then there's also mine. And then Scottsdale Mustang, Prescott Library, and Fountain Hills Recreation Center. So we're all over the valley, and I'll be doing my tax efficiency and retirement classes. Certainly that's a lot better one visually, and I promise I'll make it useful and somewhat entertaining for you. If you've been to our classes, you know I do the best I can at that. Grayson, where are you going next week?
Orlando.
Are you going to go give Mickey Mouse a big hug?
Nope.
No? Why would you go to Orlando with kids and not go see Mickey Mouse?
You asked if I was going to give Mickey Mouse a hug. I don't plan on doing that. I'm sure my 4-year-old will.
Awesome. All right. Well, you have a safe trip. Enjoy the week next week. I will be in the office slaving away while you're enjoying Disney World with the children.
That's the way I like it.
All right, everybody have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon.